What's cooking on 95BFM? Thanks to audioculture.co.nz, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Te pātaka korihi o ngā pōro o Aotearoa.
Simon Gregg, can you hear me? Okay.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, Simon.
Can you hear us?
Hello, Simon. Are you there?
I can hear you vaguely in the background.
Very vaguely. Okay.
Can you hear me at all?
I can hear you.
Just?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you perfectly clearly. Crisp as a bell.
Okay, well, I'll muddle my way through it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Simon, you have written a fantastic article on audio culture titled New Zealand Rare Record Prices Digging for Gold. Tell us about this article.
Well, it was kind of a personal thing to start with. I've been buying and collecting New Zealand music now for longer than I care to admit. And records that I was paying, you know, $5 for or $10 for 5 years ago are now starting to go for hundreds or even thousands of dollars. And it's been a slow creep over the last, maybe the last 6 or 7 years. And you've seen, like, every year another $100 gets added to a price for a record. And I kind of thought I wanted to document it. And I was of two minds doing it. First of all, because I'm a collector and I'd like to buy records. I don't want to pay $1,000 for a 45. So I didn't want to push the prices up anymore. But I also thought it was an interesting social phenomenon. It kind of needed to be documented. And it kind of also implied that New Zealand music had more worth, I think, now to current generations than it had in the past. So, yeah, I wrote the story.
Do you think it's the local market or the international market driving up these prices?
Well, it's a mixture of both. The international market's been quite high for a long time. You've had especially Europeans and Japanese and Americans paying huge sums for records you could still buy fairly cheaply in New Zealand. Example like the Human Instinct's first couple of albums were reasonably cheap until 10 years or so ago, but Germans in particular for some reason loved the band and were paying like $500 to $1,000 for the record. So people in New Zealand, like a lot of traders, were buying records cheaply in New Zealand and putting them on eBay and selling them to offshore people, which for high prices.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a personal limit as to what you would spend on a New Zealand record that you'd admit to on the radio?
Oh, God, yeah. I kind of do, and I've broken that rule a couple of times. But there were probably two records I really wanted, but I didn't have copies of, and they both went for far more than I had said I would pay for them. But then, like, one of the records I wanted most. One of the rarest records on Zodiac I wanted, I was willing to go to about $300 or $400 for a month or so ago, and I got it for $90.
Oh, there you go.
So it kind of works both ways, evens out.
Now, one of the first artists you've selected for us this evening is called the Blue Stars. What can you tell me about this band, and why do you think it's so desirable amongst collectors?
Well, it's been desirable for a long time, and for good reasons. It's an incredible record. It was a band from Auckland Grammar in the mid-1960s, who were a bunch of schoolboys, basically, and they decided to make a record. And they had a guy who was their manager who said, you know, I'll put some money up towards this. So he managed to convince a record company called Allied International that they should release this record. So sound unheard, they went into the studio with I hate the word legendary, but this kind of works in this case, a guy called Wahanui Wynyard, who was an engineer at Astor Studios, and he was renowned for making grungy records using very limited technology, basically working on two-track and bouncing things down. And anyway, he managed to turn out probably a dozen phenomenal records, and this is one of the very first he did. And it's like the prototype punk record, really. It's lyrically, it's quite snarly, and it's almost like a Sex Pistols sort of attitude towards, you know, a fuck you attitude. But it was just a fantastic record. And it's also a record that didn't sell vast numbers of copies when it came out. So it's long been very sought after, but once again, you could pick it up fairly cheaply, maybe 15 years or so ago, unless you wanted to buy it in Europe, in which case it was going for like $1,000 at that stage.
Holy moly. All right, well, let's hit play on this, and we'll come back and chat to you in about 2.5 minutes, Simon.
Cool.
The Blue Stars, Social End Product. Simon Gregg on the line all the way from Thailand. Can you hear me, mate? Is that any better?
I can hear you. Yep.
Just
you hear me all right?
Or loud enough?
No,
have
no,
I got any louder?
Clear.
Okay, sweet. Awesome.
Crystal clear now, yeah.
Awesome. Now, the next band we've got lined up is the Suburban Reptiles. Now, this is a band that is dear to your heart, and you had a hand in forming them. What can you tell us about them?
About the band themselves? Well,
the band themselves and this release.
Okay. So the band themselves were one of the two or three first punk bands in New Zealand, in Auckland anyway, but I'd say in New Zealand. And, yeah, I was involved in the very early days. It was my idea to put the band together to start with. And so I went around and visited some friends and said, let's form a punk band, because I'd read a little thing in a NME, or Melody Maker, about the Sex Pistols, a live review before they'd made a record. So I thought, this sounds like an idea. I went around to some friends' place and said, let's form a punk band. And they all said, what's punk? So we kind of worked out what it was, and it became the Suburban Reptiles. And along the way, they recorded two singles. The first single was a 12-inch single. It was the very first 12-inch single to be released by anybody in New Zealand, called Megaton. And that's rare. We sold like maybe, I don't know, 500 copies of that, I think. And yet it's the second single, which came about 6 months later, which is the one that goes for the really big money. Megaton goes for big money as well. But the second single, Saturday Night Stay at Home, was actually named by BFM in 2000, 2001 as the greatest New Zealand single of all time. So there we go. That was a popular vote. And the great thing about the second single was it was a perfect pop song. Even though it was a punk record, it was a perfect pop song. It was written by Buster Stiggs. He's no longer with us. And it was produced by Phil Judd, ex-Split Enz and later The Swingers, and recorded very quickly in Auckland at Mandrill Studios, a fantastic video made by TVNZ of all people. And yeah, so now for years the song, the single kind of did okay sales-wise. It was selling for like $50 or $100. And then about, once again, 5 or 6 years ago, it started to go ballistic. And I think the last price I saw for it was $1,900.
Oh my God.
A month or so ago. Yeah. So people are paying $1,900 for the 7-inch single. And how many were pressed? I really don't know. I'm not sure. We think maybe about 500 or 1,000, but certainly no more than that. And the fact that it was a popular record at the time amongst the punks meant it didn't survive. So when to find a mint copy is very, very hard.
That makes sense.
And every time it comes up, it goes on Trade Me, it seems to jump another $300 or $400. So yeah.
Wow. Let's hear it. So Suburban Reptiles.
I do have the master tape.
Oh, you do? The master tape. Are you going to press some more? Like do a.
Probably not. There was a limited edition that was done for Record Store Day about 3 years ago, I think. And there was 50 copies pressed, I think. I can't remember exactly how many. Wasn't that many anyway. Maybe it was 250 copies were pressed and 50 were gold.
Are the represses fetching pretty penny?
They're going for money as well, of course. Yeah. Not anything like the original, but yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. All right, let's hear it. This is Suburban Reptiles, Saturday Night, Stay at Home. Suburban Reptiles, Saturday Night, Stay at Home. We've got Simon Grigg on the line from Audio Culture talking about a recent article he's written for the site called New Zealand Rare Record Prices Digging for Gold. Now, Simon, do some of these records which go up in value, does that happen behind the scenes? It must be quite a frequent occurrence that the band members actually have no idea that their work from many years ago suddenly got a bunch of value, especially, you know, from overseas, you know, buyers.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, I mean, obviously some members of the bands seem to be fairly aware of what's going on because they're online a lot or they're on, you know, on social media. But I don't think that, you know, a lot of band members, especially older bands, that, that people aren't online or they've moved on or they've died or whatever, you know. That. And I know with the Suburban Reptiles single, the at least two members of the band are kind of well aware of what's you know, the value of these records. But I'd suggest that two aren't. I mean, obviously, Buster's no longer with us, and Bones didn't play on this particular record. He left the band before that, and he's passed on as well. But, I mean, Billy's in the UK, and I'm not sure he has any idea of how much his records are selling for these days. And Tony, who was the bass player in the band, may know. I'm not sure. It's really, you know, case by case, I think. And a lot of the members of the bands don't have their own records, of course, either, which is another thing.
Do you think there would be, I guess if they suddenly had the need to own it, they're probably going to be one of those people potentially paying those exorbitant prices for it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know some band members, you know, regarded as in the past, so it doesn't really matter particularly. So, and I do feel kind of bad when you see somebody looking at a record that they never made a cent out of, seeing it selling for, you know, $1,000, $2,000. It's but it's, what can you do?
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's like, you know, Van Gogh's and descendants relatives looking at his paintings, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the next band you've got lined up for us is The Pleasers, and a song called Sometimes. What can you tell us about this particular track?
Well, I threw it in there as much as anything because you got to have Zodiac Records in the mix when you're talking about classic New Zealand records and ones that are worth a lot of money. Now, Zodiac, as a lot of people know, was a record label. It was around in the 60s and 70s, or 50s actually, before that. And it was one of the possibly the greatest New Zealand record label of all time in terms of like setting the setting up independent music in New Zealand to be what it is today. And they made hundreds of records. A lot of them are a little bit naff, but a lot of them are great as well. And amongst the great records they made in the studio, which at this stage was in a suburban street in Herne Bay, was an album and a series of singles by The Pleasers, who were an Australian band who were brought to New Zealand by the record company, by Aldred Stebbing, who owned the record company, to replace another band on his roster, the Laddidars, who had moved to Australia. If you follow what I'm saying. So he went to Australia and he tracked down, asked what sort of bands were around, and somebody suggested a band called the Bee Gees, and he didn't think they rated, so he brought the Pleasers back.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
He's the man that turned down the Bee Gees, but we all have those sort of things in our past, I guess. Anyway, the Pleasers came to New Zealand and made a series of great sort of garage band 45s. And they also made this album, which is called Definitively Pleasers. And it's one of the great things about the Stebbing Zodiac setup was they had this great studio setup. They made great records. They were well produced. They weren't shitty, you know, in a garage sort of productions. They were actually, well, they were actually recorded in a rumpus room, some of these, but Aldred Stebbing was a whiz with the studio techniques, and he made phenomenal records. So the Pleasers album, Definitively Pleasers, was one of the first records to take off price-wise. And there was a listing that went online about 2008, 2009, I think, of the most valuable New Zealand records. And this was number one. This album was number one. And at that stage, people in Europe were paying $2,000 for this album.
Oh, my God. It's outrageous. I actually didn't think...
Because it didn't sell vast quantities. You know, that's the thing about a lot of these records, too. They only sold a few hundred copies.
Wow. That's mind-blowing. I thought
they went
only
to parties.
Yeah, I just thought it was the Beatles and Bowie and bands like that that really crept up around that mark.
No, well, there are a few New Zealand records that were up there beforehand. And as I say, they weren't selling for that sort of price in New Zealand. They were selling in Europe, and especially Germany and Spain for some reason, and Japan. The Japanese pay crazy money for records.
Mm.
So collectors overseas kind of knew about a lot of these records before people in New Zealand did. And it wasn't really until things like the Frenzy record label, which is owned by Grant Galanders, and Audio Culture, and a few other things, the Socialand product, which was being put out by John Baker and Andrew Schmidt, a few things like that, and all of a sudden they started to creep up in New Zealand as well.
Mm.
And then a couple of buyers in New Zealand, one buyer in particular in Queenstown, Wanaka, I think, started paying crazy money. So once that sort of turns into a, you know, snowball effect, they all start creeping up.
Mm. All right. Well, shall we hear this Pleasers tune? It's called Sometimes.
Yeah, play it.
Now, Simon, most of these records have found their way onto Spotify. How would that usually go about with, or come about with, you know, most of these bands being, I guess, sort of buried deep in the past?
Well, there's been two processes really that's pushed a lot of the stuff onto Spotify, which is, first of all, Chris Caddick, who is the former head of EMI in New Zealand, and was one of the people that helped me set up Audio Culture way back in the day. He has been involved in a program working with the record companies to put all New Zealand music online, basically. And the current New Zealand stuff, of course, goes online as a matter of course, because that's how you sell music a lot of the time these days. But a lot of the older stuff it sits in the archives, and it's too expensive to press it up again and that sort of thing. So he determined, with backing from Recorded Music New Zealand and the record companies, that they would go out there and they would try and put every New Zealand record ever recorded online. And he's done, so far I think he's put 400 albums up, and some of which are compilations of singles and that sort of thing. And now he's starting to dig deeper into the archives of tracks that were only on singles by bands that only made two singles and that sort of thing. But it's meant that we've got a lot of this stuff now available to listen to online. And the Pleasers were part of that. Well, the Pleasers kind of weren't part of that. Pleasers were started part of a parallel program by Zodiac, by Steppings, to put their catalogue all online too. And they've, I think, gone to every single artist they can track down and got permission, and although they probably own the rights to it anyway, but they've talked to the artists and they're paying royalties on these tracks when they can find the people and that sort of thing. But they have put all their stuff online as well. That's, and done a whole series of theme compilations.
Because I was going to ask, yeah, it must be a difficult process getting permission and sorting out publishing. Does it push the value of the publishing up?
I suppose it does in a way. I mean, a lot of their songs from the 60s in particular are cover versions. So the publishing money is going offshore anyway. That last song, the Pleasers track we played, was I can't remember who wrote it, but it was a cover. I think every track on their album was a cover of something else from somewhere overseas. But they were kind of reimagined quite well often, and they were unique. In fact, that Pleasers track that we played, that version, their version of that track sometimes was the basis for an American band called the Flaming Groovies to do a cover of the same song in the 1970s. So they took the cover of the cover, you know, and they made their own version of it on an album called Shakes in Action.
Nice.
So it kind of went round. But yeah, people get paid, which is good. I mean, it's Spotify, so they get paid bugger all, but at least as an amount.
Yeah, nice one. Yeah. Now, the next band you've selected for us is from Fiji.
They are from Fiji, and they were fantastic. Now, I never saw them live, but apparently they were fantastic. They were the resident band at a club in Suva called the Golden Dragon, from memory, which was a classic tourist nightclub. And they played 7 days a week, probably, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day, sort of like the Beatles did when they went to Hamburg. So these guys were shit hot live. They were fantastic. And they came to New Zealand. They were invited to New Zealand to play and make a record, and by a guy called Ed Morris. And Ed Morris brought them in, and he did a deal with Polygram at the time and recorded one album. And they only pressed up 300 copies of this album, which is called Turn On to Music. And so it became, over the years, it was always very, very rare. And it was reissued, I think, maybe 3 years ago or 4 years ago by Universal. We actually did a vinyl reissue of it. And it's been reissued as a bootleg maybe half a dozen times in Europe. So, and it's regarded as like a jazz, rock, prog, funk, whatever, mishmash, classic, because it was a great record, basically. It was well recorded in Wellington, and yeah, a fantastic record. Right. They went back to Fiji, and I don't know how long they played after that, but yeah.
Let's hear it. This is Mantis with a song called Turn Onto Music.
Go take a beat of a different drama, take a good time.
That was fun. What year was that, Simon?
1973.
So just before Blurter?
Yeah, well, it was.
Yeah,
it has that same sort of early 70s sort of funk feel about it.
Yeah, it's fun.
Very much the same sort of style.
There's something to be said
and Ed
for...
Ed Morris, who produced it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was just going to say there's something to be said for playing 7 days a week, 4 hours a day as a band. You get pretty tight.
Yeah, it kind of turns you into a professional band, I suppose. And I can imagine they were playing a lot of that sort of funk and soul stuff, Santana and that sort of thing at the time. So you can hear it coming through. But it has that sort of... It has also a fairly unique mix of all that sort of stuff too. Apparently they were much heavier live. You know, that's what the record sounded like, so...
Just to reiterate, if you have just tuned in, we're talking to Simon Grigg from Audio Culture about his recent article, New Zealand Rare Record Prices Digging for Gold. Totally fascinating. It's bizarre what sort of crosses over and then people sort of ascribe value to at some point. Has there been anything that has been really surprising or any... strange vines, you're like, wow, it's amazing that this record is selling for $1 zillion now.
Well, some of the things that are starting to creep up in price are kind of interesting. Like, there's almost become a New Zealand collecting frenzy. There's there's a great Facebook group which is set up by collectors, New Zealand music collectors, and it started off with about 100 people, and they're all putting up the rarities, the stuff. You know, I've got a copy of this, and it's a boast thing as much as anything. And it's basically a bunch of boys boasting, and I'm afraid it is mostly boys, boasting about their vinyl collections. Mm. But as time's gone on, it's expanded out, and so more and more people have started to join this, which is cool. But you're starting to notice the odd thing coming up, and you're going, really? That's collectible now?
Mm.
And one of the things that's kind of struck me is things that are collectible are the solid gold hits type compilations.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I don't know if you've been into op shops and, you know, and charity shops, but the vinyl bins used to be full of these things.
Mm.
20 Solid Gold Hits, Volume 53, and that sort of stuff.
Yes, I'm familiar.
And now you're seeing people who are collecting these whole sets. Guys going, I'm only missing number 27.
I tend to stay away from those compilations because they press so many songs on a record that those tracks tend to skip and stick. Have you ever noticed
that? And they fade them down too.
Yes, very
annoying.
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah.
They go, you know, you get a song which is 4 minutes long and at 2 minutes 20, they'll fade it out.
The disappointment of I Love Rock and Roll fading out in the second chorus when I was 12 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always the good part, especially if it's a great song, like a David Bowie song or something. You know, it's gonna the good part is going to be in the second part of the song.
Mm.
But no.
Now, Simon, the last song you have selected for us this evening is by a band called The Chicks. What can you tell us about The Chicks?
Okay, well, The Chicks should be famous, and I think they kind of are. The Chicks were two sisters from West Auckland who were discovered at a birthday party in Henderson, I think it was, about 1964, 65, and they were signed to Viking Records. And became big pop stars, touring around New Zealand. They had about, I don't know, 8 or 9 top 10 singles, and their stuff's become pretty collectible over the years. It's kind of nice, garagey, sort of pop R&B flavoured stuff, often produced in Mascot Studios in Eden Terrace. And they left Viking Records in 1966, and I'm not sure why. Maybe their contract was up or they had a falling out or whatever, and they signed to another record label called Impact. Impact was a brand new record label, and it was set up by Benny Levin, who was a music producer, promoter, and he signed the band up, and the first single was a single called Tweedledee. And Tweedledee was generously naff. It was like a very lightweight sort of bubblegum sort of record, and the band hated it. The sisters hated it. Suzanne and Judy, they didn't like it at all. But the B-side of the record was shit hot. I think I've used that word a couple of times before, but the B-side of the record was what everyone wanted and still do. The song wasn't a big hit because the A side was not a great track, but the B side was The Rebel Kind, and it was written by Lee Hazelwood, who Nancy Sinatra records.
What?
And stuff,
really?
Duetting with her. But he's also, yeah. Yeah, he wasn't a New Zealander. He was from California.
Yes, yeah, I'm familiar with Lee Hazelwood. That's incredible that he wrote the song.
So it was a cover version of something that he'd written, yep. I think. I have no, yeah, they're all covers, these songs.
Mm.
But I'm not sure who did the original. Somebody might know and be able to text in. But the B-side, The Rebel Kind, was backed by the Mike Pajanic group. Which was Mike Pajanic was a major player around Auckland at the time, played in a lot of clubs and things, and later went on to become the head of APRA in Australia. So man with a bit of a pedigree. But the band featured a guitarist called Doug Gerabine, who's one of the most famous guitarists of the 60s in New Zealand.
Jesse Harper?
And he was famous for Jesse Harper, that's the guy, right?
Yeah.
And he made one killer album. And I think he still lives on Waiheke these days, and he plays every now and again. But he called the guitar on the B side of it Stun Guitar. And it's just fuzzy, sort of like over the top guitar. You'll hear it soon. And yeah, it sank without trace, the record, basically. And I'd looked at Discogs just before, and there's one copy on Discogs at the moment for $800.
Goodness gracious.
So, yeah, fantastic record, great band, and a wonderful performance of the song, and it's disappeared without trace.
All right, let's hear it, and we'll come back and wrap things up with you.
Okay.
The Chicks, The Rebel Kind, as selected from Simon Gregg, representing Audio Culture this evening. Thank you, mate. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you all the way from Thailand.
Yeah, excuse me. Yes, yeah, kind of wasn't expecting to be talking to BFM today, but here we go.
It's kind of BFM style, though.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm.
Now, if people want to head along to Audio Culture, if they haven't before, how would you describe it to listeners, Simon Grigg?
Well, the the tag we use is the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music, and it's kind of like, it was set up originally because a lot of stuff wasn't online, it wasn't documented, a lot of the New Zealand musical history, it's all about New Zealand music history, it wasn't online, and I kind of figured out that if we didn't tell our own stories, like in music, I'm from the music industry originally, if the music industry didn't tell our own stories, then nobody else is going to, so... Mm.
Because
that's what we did.
There hadn't been many biographies. I mean, there'd been Stranded in Paradise, and Gareth Shute wrote quite a comprehensive document of like later 90s and stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, and there was a couple of books that a guy called Roger Watkins put out of bands in the 60s in Wellington and Auckland, which is, but they're all rare. You know, those books were, they get printed and they disappear. So, original copies of Stranded in Paradise now go for decent money as well.
Cool. I treasure my original copy, signed by John Dix.
And also a lot of the bands from the 90s, when the internet first turned up, they did a website, which is great, but then the band breaks up and no one's going to pay for the hosting anymore and it kind of disappears. Mm. So we just thought that we have to tell our own stories and we have to... I went to the government and tried to get some government funding to go and do this, and eventually they said yes. New Zealand On Air said yes. Mm. So I do think when we first set it up, it was probably unique around the world. There's probably others around the world of a similar sort of doing the same sort of thing now, but it was important to tell our own stories while we had the ability to do so and the money to do so.
Yeah, totally. I can genuinely say it's an incredible resource, and I always enjoy having a bit of a snoop around and just stumbling across incredible articles.
Yeah, it's a delight to follow on Facebook when articles pop up.
And it's kind of like an endless ball of string too, I think. Like you go in there, it's like Wikipedia, and you go in there and there's links to click to, and you go off to the next thing and it takes you keep on going.
Absolutely.
Which is
yeah,
always the intent.
I like all the hyperlinks, yeah.
Nice one. All right, well, Simon Grigg from Audio Culture, thank you once again for chatting to us this evening. And, keep an eye on Audio Culture, everyone. If you haven't checked it out, jump online, audioculture.co.nz.
Nice to hear from you, Simon.
Nice to hear from you too.
Simon, just while I'm thinking about it, do you want to do a voice ID for 95BFM?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so you can just sort of ad lib it. Are you familiar with that Flavor Flav one where he goes, come on down and be a friend of me over and over and over again of me? You're checking out the flyer show ever right here in New Zealand.
No, but you knew that.
If you, anything like that, you've got up your sleeve, Simon.
Oh, God, you're throwing me this.
Just kidding.
Just go for it, Simon.
Hold on, let me have a think. Hi, this is Simon Grigg. You're listening to 95BFM, and I've been listening to 95BFM since it was called something else.
It's perfect. Perfect, Simon. Awesome.
Okay.
All right. We'll check in with you sometime in the future, no doubt. All the best.
Okay. Speak soon.
Bye.
Bye.
What's cooking on 95BFM? Thanks to audioculture.co.nz, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Te pātaka korihi o ngā pōro o Aotearoa.